Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Today is May 1st, May Day. And in cities across the Bay Area, from Concord to San Jose, communities rouse in protest and workplaces shut down as employees walked off the job to denounce the Trump administration's stance against immigrant rights. May 1st is also known as International Workers' Day and is celebrated widely across the globe. May Day's association with the labor movement is attributed to the commemoration of those killed in the Haymarket Affair of the late 1800s, when several were shot rallying for an 8-hour workday and in a bombing that followed. The 40-hour workweek, paid time off, and job security are benefits that many in today's workforce expect and take for granted. These protections were hard won after years of organized struggle led by unions in the face of violence, threats of violence, loss of jobs, and corporate intimidation. Today, however, only 1 in 10 American workers are unionized, and many other working people, largely immigrants and people of color, are systematically underemployed, thus minimizing their access to crucial workplace benefits. Yet, we have seen gains in California, such as the fight for a living minimum wage, and a resurgence in organizing for immigrant protections and rights. So what strategies is organized labor adopting in the pro-corporate, anti-immigrant environment of our current administration to both maintain and increase gains? What is the current state of the labor movement in the Bay Area and California, and what are the priorities and opportunities for labor's future? And what can the immigrants' rights movement and the labor movement stand to gain from each other, and what might be areas for divergence and splintering? And then, when it comes to today's demonstrations, what message did they send and to whom? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these questions and more are Nato Green, comedian and strategic campaigns coordinator for the Service Employees International Union, 1021. Welcome, Nato.
Hi.
We're also joined by phone by two guests. First, we're joined by Lemoyne Werlein-Hyane, director of the Leadership Development Program at Berkeley's Center for Labor Research and Education. Welcome, Lemoyne.
Thank you. Good evening.
And we're also joined by phone by Steve Smith. He's communication director for the California Labor Federation. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks very much for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Were you out there demonstrating today? We want to hear from you. Want to hear about your experiences and what you made out of what happened today around the Bay Area. So first, I want to turn that same question to our guests to find out what you know about what happened out there today. I'll ask you first, Nato Green. What's your understanding of who turned out and how many people turned out?
Today started out, there was a national call for walkouts today, all over the country. So early this morning, people were, protesting on the East Coast. We were getting word, that people were doing, sit-ins at immigration offices, in San Francisco at 8 a.m. There was a group of people who did civil disobedience and blockaded the immigration office in San Francisco. People were also doing civil disobedience sitting in at the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. And then the protests kicked off through the day. There were actions in San Francisco, in San Jose, in Oakland this afternoon, in Santa Rosa, in Concord, in Sacramento. So there were sort of feeder marches of different constituencies. Like, the teachers would start over here and then march in and join the bigger thing. I was out in the San Francisco march. It was very big. We went down Market Street, and I am not someone who is good at estimating crowds, but it was real big, and. I was there with a big group of kids a lot of schools in San Francisco have significant foreign-born student populations, and there was a pretty high level of participation. Like, a lot of the public schools sort of they can't say don't come to school in protest, but they've said just so you know, there's a lot of immigrants going to this thing that's happening. Just FYI, we're going to have school, but just in case, nothing's going to be happening here. It's all going to be downtown. So, like, we, you know, marched with a lot of kids from San Francisco public schools who had made their own signs and stuff like that.
And what were the messages that you heard today?
There was a contingent of the Migration is Beautiful Butterfly, made by Oakland artist Fabiana Rodriguez. There was a lot of people chanting things like "No ban, no wall, sanctuary for all," and, you know, tying together the Muslim ban and the attacks on immigrants. There was a lot of stuff connecting, you know, the immigrant struggle to worker struggles. I mean, at this point, talking about the immigrant rights movement separate from the labor movement is difficult in many quarters, and so there was a lot of kind of the we're all immigrants kind of groovy messages like that. And then there was a, you know, good contingent of like smash the state and death the capital kind of people. So there was that there. It was pretty broad. And then a lot of like, we hate Trump.
And so what did you not see or what did you not hear?
One thing that I didn't see is the police. So it's interesting when there's, at least in the part of the San Francisco March that I was, there was no police presence. So there was not a visible concern by the city of San Francisco that, like, that there was going to be a crackdown of some sort. I was at the science march recently, and it was pretty striking. The march today was much more racially diverse than the science march, and less nerds and whatnot. Like the science march, people marched out of UCSF Mission Bay, you know, biotech camp labs to come down to the science march, and this was there was a lot of young people there. A lot of families, a lot of kids. I saw a lot of people in suits on the sides of Market Street rubbernecking and taking pictures with their phones. I didn't see any kind of counter protest today, which was very refreshing.
And was there, did you feel like there was a unified message here?
I don't think that there's ever a unified message in a march. And I think that's sort of by design. Like, you know, I think that's a good thing. There was a unified spirit. Like, I think that there's a recognition at this point that because the extreme right wing that has hijacked the American government is like targeting everybody, that they're trying, you know, targeting immigrants from Latin America and Mexico, as well as Muslims, as well as scientists, as well as women, as well as GLBT people, as well as union members, as well as students, you know, that like, there were people there from it's easy to make the connections because there's nobody has any illusions at this point that, like, you know, I can cut a deal with the government for my group and then sell everyone else out. It's sort of like, well, out of necessity we are all in this together. So groups that were like not necessarily trying to figure out solidarity with each other 10 years ago are there now, and so there was the vibe was very celebratory, festive. You know, there was people drumming and chanting, and it was a good mood. It wasn't somber at all. There's always this quiet conversation about, like, what effect does it have, and do the other side care and whatever. And frequently with these things, I think the biggest effect is on the people who participate, and that people get transformed by their participation in these kinds of activities that then they take back into the rest of their lives as people take steps to, like, you know, I guess I have to spend 5 hours a week now to save the world from fascism, and that's my price of existence.
I want to turn to some of our other guests to get their take on today. Lemoine Werlein-Hayane of the Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. My understanding is that you were also out and about today?
Yes, correct. I did participate in the demonstration in San Francisco, and certainly been following online all the different demonstrations going on around the country. I think it's a very important day. It's certainly a day where immigrant rights and the situation facing refugees in this country was front and center. And I think that this, in many respects, it follows a trend that we've seen for the better part of 15 years now, where it's really been the immigrant rights demonstrations that have brought back May Day and that have brought back that tradition to the labor movement from which it was born. So I think that this is a very positive development, and to the degree to which immigrants in this country are playing a leading role in pushing forward the labor movement, giving voice to the labor movement, I think is part of the best traditions of the American labor movement.
So tell us a little bit more about your personal experience in the march here in San Francisco, and then a little sampling of what you've been seeing in the media online and reports about other demonstrations across the country.
Well, I think my friend and colleague, Nato, I gave a good flavor for the demonstration today. The only thing I would add is that I think it was a first show of force, if you will, explicitly around immigration like this, since the Trump administration has begun to settle in. I think that there is, in fact, a great deal of fear out there in the immigrant communities about what the Trump administration may bring. And certainly the early indications are very negative. But that much said, I think that we're at the beginnings of a process of recomposing the alliances that we saw 10 years ago in 2016, putting together the organizations, the various movements that came together at that time to really build a mass protest fight back, if you will, that was truly historic. So I think we're at the beginning phases of that, and I do believe in the upcoming weeks and months that this kind of outward expression is being followed up by a lot of grassroots organizing and a lot more local political battles and so forth.
And anything you'd like to point out about demonstrations in other parts of the country?
A sampling, just looking around, there's been a variety of demonstrations all over the country. L.A. Was a substantial demonstration, from what I understand. Tens of thousands of folks took to the streets. A massive demonstration in Milwaukee, Chicago, New York, as Nato pointed out, news from other parts of the country. And I think that, you know, it really is a melding of immigration rights and labor rights, and certainly a lot of other folks who've been impacted by the Trump administration joining in. So it is a little bit more diverse even than the 2006 demonstrations in that respect. But I do think that in many ways we really are at the beginning of a lot of processes, and I would not judge the strength or weakness or initiative of immigrant rights demonstrations or labor, for that matter, based on today. Today was a great show of force, if you will.
So would you say that today was just as much about galvanizing a coalition as it was about sending a very particular message and staking a claim?
I think it was both of those things. I think within the context of immigrant rights, I think that there are a lot of discussions and debates going on about how to pull together the various components and organizations and movements that came together in a previous time, in the faith community, in labor, obviously immigrant rights and immigrants being front and center to that process. So I think there's a lot of discussion about how to put those alliances back together, how to give life to those alliances organizationally and turn them into real programmatic coalitions. I think there's a lot of discussion going on about what are the appropriate demands and what are the appropriate focuses for those demands. A lot of protest has been emerging around ICE detention centers or just offices of immigration enforcement as one strategy. Certainly the sanctuary cities has been another strategy. And attempting to expand that concept to include sanctuary hotels and sanctuary unions and so forth. So I think that there is a lot of very important critical energy out there, and the key thing is to what degree it gets transmitted into ongoing grassroots organizing.
I know, Nato, you wanted to say something here, but I want to make sure we get Steve Smith in first, Communications Director for the California Labor Federation. Steve, were you out today in the demonstrations?
I was. I was here in Sacramento, and we had a very strong showing here. But I would also, just to add on in terms of what happened in Los Angeles today, You know, what was really striking about what happened down there is there were more than 100 organizations that made up the 2017 May Day Coalition. We're talking about many labor unions, but also groups like the ACLU, LGBT groups, Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, immigrant rights groups. So I think, you know, the message that comes out of today is just the solidarity that exists within the resistance movement. I think that's a very, very good sign going forward, to have so many groups on the same page in terms of fighting back against the dangerous agenda that we're seeing come out of Washington.
And so being in Sacramento, where were the politicians today?
Yeah, so we saw a number of legislators come out, show their support for the march and the marchers. Just generally a lot of support from the state capitol and our legislators here, which again, you know, a very good sign. We have the most pro-worker legislature, pro-immigrant legislature in the country, and this legislature has not been afraid to stand up to Donald Trump, and I think we're going to continue to see that.
So, Nato, you wanted to add something earlier as I was asking the question, I think, about sort of what is the purpose or what was the outcome of today?
Well, I wanted to go back to what Lemoyne had alluded to about 2006, which was, you know, the women's marches in January were the biggest marches in American history. The estimate was about that 3 million people were in the streets on January 21st.
Who was doing the counting?
Not me.
Okay.
And prior to that, the biggest marches in American history was May Day 2006, and it was the immigrant rights marches against the Sensenbrenner bill that was the, you know, touted as comprehensive immigration reform, but that was mostly punitive, you know, and an enforcement border security model. And there was this upsurge of immigrant organizing that has, you know, for the last decade, out of the 2006 marches and all the walkouts that happened of protesting that bill. Not only did it ultimately stop that bill, but then created the sort of infrastructure for the immigrant rights movement that we're seeing, you know, coming together today. And some of the conversation that I've been hearing from the immigrant rights organizers is like these, you know, kind of a sense of these people are coming for us anyway, so we may as well sort of, you know, face them fighting.
Hmm. So I wanted to pull back a bit to this notion that, you know, as much as the labor movement and immigrants' rights movements are kind of synonymous or continuous with each other, that it wasn't always like that, right? I think Lemoyne, you mentioned that it was about 15 years ago where this shift occurred. So just for a little history lesson, why wasn't it, and what did it take to make that change? Lemoyne, do you want to start there?
Well, I would offer two thoughts here. One is that on one hand, we need to recognize and understand that immigrants and immigrant rights, in fact, have been central to the evolution of the American labor movement since its inception. It was Polish and German, East European, Italian, Irish immigrants who populated the labor movement in its inception in this country. And if you look back at that time, back to the late 1800s and the beginning of the turn of the 20th century, you'll notice that a lot of unions were actively agitating and supporting the rights of their members with respect to citizenship, with respect to voting rights, with respect to a whole range of issues. Now, that much said, there's also a very conservative strain within the American labor movement, and there's always been that strain of nativism as well, and it's always been there. Officially, the AFL-CIO had adopted a rather nativist and exclusionary position on immigration, dating back to the 50s through into the 90s. But there was at some point a reform movement that began to come together within labor, championed by activists throughout the country in different organizations, and organized under the Labor Immigrant Organizing Network, LION, which really agitated amongst unions to build support for a change in the AFL-CIO's position on labor. And that change came in the 90s. And from that moment forward, I think that the national labor movement and most of the large internationals in this country have really very steadily and very deliberately begun to adopt a pro-immigrant position, a position that supports comprehensive immigration reform, including the legalization of the status of those individuals undocumented in this country. So the debates around immigration within the labor movement are reflective of very long-term trends, some of which I think point to some of the best traditions of the American labor movement, and some of which point to some of the more negative nativist aspects of the American labor movement.
And by nativist, but are you right just now, saying white here? Let's be clear.
Yeah, that would absolutely be the case. And there's a whole other conversation to be had about racism and how that's affected African Americans in this country and the labor movement. So, but that's a whole other conversation. But at this present time, I do think it's important to highlight that on paper, at least, the labor movement is taking very progressive pro-immigrant positions.
And do you see that across the country, or are we saying that California perhaps is L.A., San Francisco, Oakland, other parts are kind of on the leading edge of that, or is this pretty much a mainstream embraced notion?
Well, the labor movement's very uneven, and there are certainly a whole range of different opinions out there that reflect the politics of this country within the labor movement. At the apex of the labor movement, if you will, or the AFL-CIO and national labor movement, I think certain positions are very strongly held at this point. And that is played out at the local level in different places in different ways. There are certainly a good number of unions that have an immigrant base within their membership, and certainly those unions have been out front taking these positions. Other unions perhaps have not had that immigrant base so strongly reflected and have taken a while to catch up, if you will.
So, Steve Smith, I wanted to turn that same kind of that question to you by asking, so what does immigrants' rights mean to the labor movement in California? And sort of, is it a matter of that labor movement kind of really needs the immigrants' rights movement to stay relevant, to stay viable?
Well, I think first and foremost, people come to the United States to work. They come to the United States for opportunity. They come to the United States to pursue the American dream. And what we see often with immigrant workers is that they are among the most exploited and vulnerable of all workers. If the labor movement is not there to protect these workers, employers are going to be able to engage in practices like wage theft, which is rampant among low-wage industries that are heavily immigrant. And so the California labor movement has really been ahead of the curve in terms of protecting immigrants, and we continue to be. Our movement in California is as diverse as the California population. We have many immigrant workers among our members, but we also understand that there are many immigrant workers that don't yet have an opportunity to join a union, and they need the protection more so than anyone else. And so we've taken this challenge very seriously in terms of protecting immigrants, not just because those immigrants are our members or may someday be our members, because it's the right thing to do. And we have passed a number of measures in the legislature here in Sacramento just in the past few years to take on things like wage theft, which again heavily impact immigrant workers. We've got a bill in the legislature right now that would protect immigrant workers at the workplace from workplace raids by ICE, which is a big threat that many immigrant workers are fearing right now. So, this is something that is, I think, in a lot of ways central to our mission, protecting the most vulnerable and exploited workers in the workforce, and many of those workers, unfortunately, are immigrants.
And how much does the leadership of the labor movement here in California and elsewhere represent the diversity of the immigrant workers that they represent?
Yeah, I think you see that starting to evolve as well. Our leadership is looking more and more like our membership, and frankly, that's the way it should be. There's been, I think, as discussed earlier, a long sort of evolution in terms of the labor movement's position on immigration. But, you know, in California, we pride ourselves on being ahead of the curve and doing what we can to protect the most vulnerable workers. And you know, I'm proud to say that that's central to our mission.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the impact of the Trump administration on the immigrants' rights movement and the labor movement with our guests, Nato Green, comedian and strategic campaigns coordinator for SEIU, that's Service Employees International Union 10-1, Lemoyne Orline Jain, who is director of the Leadership Development Program at Berkeley's Center for Labor Research and Education, Orline Hyain, sorry about that, and Steve Smith, Communications Director for the California Labor Federation. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. What was today like for you? Were you out in the streets? Are you a represented worker? Are you not? We want to hear from you. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Do you see that there are differences or should be differences between the immigrants' rights movement and the labor movement? 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, our Facebook page, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Nato, I wanted to wrap up this piece around the connection between immigrants' rights movements and the labor movement. What's your take about on this here in San Francisco and the Bay Area?
I think that there's been a couple of different threads to it. I mean, one sort of in the purely self-interested sense, there was the nativism that Lemoyne was alluding to in the labor movement was motivated by kind of the, like, you know, they're taking our jobs kind of argument. And at some point there was a recognition that if employers can get away with exploiting immigrant workers, it's going to lower standards for everybody. And so even people who may not have known or liked immigrants for a moral reason recognized that that it was in their interest to be champions on behalf of immigrants. The other aspect is that I think the labor movement sort of does best when it's in conversation or interaction with social movements outside of it. And it has always been the case that social movements that develop in society at large sort of make their way into the labor movement in some fashion. And some of the most dramatic and effective and exciting organizing that's happened in the labor movement in the last generation has been immigrant workers. Janitors, hotel workers, food service workers, healthcare workers, home care workers, et cetera. And so I think the labor movement recognizes that this is where the action is, and we want to be, that we have an interest in supporting this community. And locally that has unfolded very positively. A lot of unions have taken on really, you know, strong pro-immigrant positions. And, you know, in here, it's become very clear, like, in the conversation about Donald Trump and the sanctuary status, in particular, like, the union that I work for, SEIU 1021, is primarily a union of public sector workers, local government. And the sanctuary policies of the Trump administration are not just about making it easier to deport immigrants, it's about defunding local government. And it's from their perspective, it's a win either way. Either we get rid of immigrants who we hate, or we get to defund social services to poor people, which we also hate. And so our union has sort of rejected that dichotomy and said, no, we have to maintain funding for things like San Francisco General Hospital and Health and Human Services and parks programs and transit and things like that, and can't make that conditional on we're not going to take scapegoating of the recipients of our services in order to protect the funding for those services.
Hmm. And Lemoyne, Reline, Hyane, I wanted to just make sure we hit this point, which is we hear in the press that it's the disaffected white male blue-collar worker who supported Trump overwhelmingly. And there's lots of questions about, you know, why did they vote? And I'm not necessarily going to rehash what has probably been talked about quite a bit about their motivations for voting for Trump over Clinton. But they were they're a very important voting bloc, and they're not the only people who voted for Trump. But they're obviously important moving forward. Do they identify with the workers, the immigrant workers' rights movement as well? And what distances may still exist?
Well, I think that there's been a variety of polls done and different studies that have shown that working people who are in unions tend to have more progressive political positions vis-a-vis the rest of the population. So I do believe that in the union environment, there is a lot of discussion and debate and information that circulates about what are the interests of workers and how those interests play out within elections or within regulatory changes and so forth. And you do see more liberal voting patterns amongst union members vis-a-vis other folks. So I think that that was present. I think that it's in this election, this last election, I think the surveying that's happened post-election indicates that Trump got a very slight bump in terms of broadly defined working class folks vis-a-vis Romney, for instance, but not really even at the levels of support that Reagan was able to engender. What's a more important trend is where the affirmative vote for Democrats over the years has been in decline. So Trump did not make any significant inroad compared to past Republican candidates, but the support for Democrats has in fact fallen off over the years and continues to. And I think that there is a widespread belief within the labor movement that the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party has been in ascendancy, and its policies of that wing have been the policies that have been dominating. So there is a feeling that within labor, widely held, that there needs to be a retooling of the Democratic Party's economic message.
And then do you want to add something there, Steve?
So I would just say that what we saw, I think, was a clear indication of the frustration that people feel given the economic insecurity that exists in this country. And that exists not just among the white working class, but among a lot of different groups. The middle class in this country is shrinking to the level that it's become an endangered species. We have seen wage stagnation occur for years now. 401ks and pensions being cut or eliminated altogether. There's a frustration that exists in this country when it comes to economic security. And so, you know, part of the reason that Trump was elected in states like Ohio and Michigan was because I think that frustration boiled up, and perhaps the Democrats weren't doing enough to address those concerns. Here in California, we saw about 70% of our union members vote for the Democrat Hillary Clinton, and that's on par with what we've seen in other elections. But again, we've got a much more diverse membership here, and we spent a lot of time and effort talking to those members about the stakes in this election. So I think that the Democratic Party has a big challenge before it. in terms to, of honing an economic message that once again gives people the confidence that the Democratic Party is going to be the party of FDR, the party of working people.
So just to encapsulate it, where are we today? And on May 1st, 2017, we have an anti-union administration and likely Congress in power. We have a Supreme Court that is shifting further right. And we have a portion of the labor electorate that supported, not necessarily those policies, but the people who espouse them. So what's the thinking now in the caucuses around the country as labor leaders get together to say, what do we do now? I'll start with you, Nate O'Green.
I think the unions have been and continue to be have there's been certain sectors where unions have been successful in growing. You know, there's been a lot of union organizing in healthcare, in the public sector, in among hotel workers and janitorial workers. There's a handful of industries, and one of the challenges that is sort of the, from my perspective, the backdrop of all of it is that the framework that we do unions in, what exists in the United States is defined by, you know, the legal structures of collective bargaining. We negotiate contracts on behalf of specific groups of workers that cover a very, you know, in some cases, very limited set of issues, and not a whole other set of issues that might be relevant and important. And, you know, that the legal framework that unions operate in was one that was created in the 30s and 40s, and it's clear that even if the idea of worker organization and worker collective struggle against inequality is as relevant today as it's ever been, the institutional vehicles that we have to achieve that goal may not be the most adapted. I mean, just as one example, there was in the last few months, there was a big study that came out of a couple of economists at Harvard and Princeton that like 100% of the net job growth in the last 10 years has been among contingent work. You know, independent contractors, temps, the gig economy, part-time, short-term, subcontracted, et cetera.
The Uber and Lyft drivers.
Right. And so, you know, that what it means to whether those people need union contracts or need some other vehicle of some other form of organization as yet unknown to make their lives better and address their aspirations and grievances in the workplace, I don't think anybody has an answer to that yet. And I feel like answering that question is sort of the thing that is hanging over all of us who do union work.
This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the immigrants' rights movement and labor movement here in California Bay Area and across the country with our guest, Nate O'Green, with the SEIU 1021. He's the Strategic Campaigns Coordinator. On the phone, we're joined by Lemoyne Orline-Hyane. He's with Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, where he leads their leadership development program, and Steve Smith, Communications Director for the California Labor Federation. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. Dial 415-841-4134 to do so. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisions. KALW. So staying with that last point that Nate mentioned, Lemoyne, what's the stance of unions at this point? Is it really just about, you know, maintaining the floor before things get further eroded? And how do you do a short game and a long game here at the same time?
Well, unfortunately, the labor movement really is at a crossroads, and it's trapped in some ways between some very long-term challenges and then immediate challenges coming from this administration. But NATO alluded to the changes and the really the upending of the legal and institutional structures that have governed labor relations in this country for the last 60 years.
And say a little bit more about that.
And those are being upended. I'm talking about the right to exclusive representation, collective bargaining, structure in this country, the right to organize in this country. The basic legal framework is being upended. At the same time, economic restructuring at the firm level, outsourcing, subcontracting, and all those changes that have happened at the level of the firm combined with a level of mergers and acquisitions and buyouts and financialization and buyouts by Wall Street, has really created a disbalance in power between employers and labor. So going forward, I think there's a lot of discussion today within the labor movement about how to deal with that disbalance, how to aggregate labor's strength, how to regain leverage in the context where employers and businesses have grown in size and in resource base while unions have shrunk, how to deal with that disbalance in the context of legal and institutional structures that are being upended. So it is certainly a very challenging situation, but I think that there are a lot of innovative strategies out there beginning to emerge that do, in fact, seek to combine labor's power, unite people, and begin to create organizational models that can match the scale and resources that the employers have.
So I'm going to stay with you because I'd love to hear some of these innovative strategies. Say more about those.
Well, there's been a variety of things that have been attempted to try to scale up labor and combine our power. One has been a real wave out there of combining small locals based in a variety of cities spread out to combine those organizationally as a way to combine resources, rationalize management, and be able to match the scale and power and resources that the employers that they face that they're dealing with. Given that those employers over time have in fact grown, merged, expanded, and so forth. So organizational changes to combine power, there's been a great deal attempts by the Hotel Workers Union, for instance, to really build a national hotel workers movement, to line up contracts across the country around common expiration dates as a means to build a national movement to confront them. There's been a lot of attempts out there to create new forms of organization. The Teamsters in Seattle, organizing Uber drivers and taxi drivers, have really been experimenting with some of what NATO was mentioning in terms of creating new forms of organizations that might not be the same as a traditional union, but is in fact a means by which a group of workers in a given industry are combining together in order to have that collective strength and leverage to deal with their employers on a more equitable basis.
And Steve Smith with the California Labor Federation, the way you've described the health, so to speak, of the labor movement here in California suggests that perhaps it's not just about maintaining the floor, so to speak, but perhaps raising the ceiling. What's on the horizon for the labor movement in California in trying to push, and how can what's done here help to raise the tide, so to speak, in other parts of the country that might be struggling?
Well, I've been privy to a lot of discussions with union leaders across the state of California, and everybody's clear that we're under attack, unprecedented attacks in the next 4 years from the GOP Congress, the Trump administration, Supreme Court. But there's also a strong sense that we are not going to spend 4 years in a defensive crouch. We're going to do what the labor movement in California has always done, and that's go on offense for workers. And, you know, just in the last few years, we've passed landmark legislation in this state that have done things like raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We've instituted a law that allows every worker in the state of California to have paid sick days on the job. We were the first state in the country to have paid family leave. You know, this year there's a lot of great legislation in the legislature right now, including bills on that are very pertinent to health care. We're sponsoring one bill that would require transparency in prescription drugs that would lower the cost of those drugs for working people and seniors. These are just some examples of the types of things that we're going to continue to do as we fend off the attacks. But going back to the question about, you know, what is the opportunity that we may have here? It's not only about fending off the threats; it's about looking at the opportunities that we have before us. And I think more than ever, working people in this country need the ability to stand together to negotiate a fair wage and decent benefits with their bosses. And we're seeing in research that we're doing right now that in particular young people in this state and Latinos in this state more so than ever are more favorable towards unions and what unions are doing. And obviously those are big populations for us in terms of future growth. So I think people recognize that going it alone no longer helps you get by. In fact, going it alone leads to you getting laid off or getting exploited at work or, you know, losing your health care or your retirement. The way that people are going to be able to get ahead is by standing together in unions, and I think more and more people are coming to that recognition as these attacks become more fierce.
And one other part that I would ask you to comment on is how much is the labor movement in California and perhaps elsewhere pushing on the Democratic Party or trying to find ways to get the Democratic Party to move in a direction that it maybe hasn't in a while? Or is this really kind of sort of no party affiliation kind of time?
Well, you know, we've always said we are not tied to either party. You know, the fact of the matter is Democrats have been much more favorable to workers and workers' interests over the years. But that doesn't mean every Democrat is like that. In fact, in California, we have kind of a unique situation here. We've got a Republican Party in California that's on life support. Fewer and fewer Californians identify with the Republican Party. That, you know, is generally a good thing for working people. But where it gets a little bit weird is when you start seeing corporate interests funneling money to Democrats, because we have a top two primary here in California. So that means in a lot of districts, especially in places like the Bay Area, you're going to see a Democrat-on-Democrat race. And corporations are funding one Democrat and labor unions are funding the other. It often confuses voters. So, yes, we're absolutely in the business of pushing our friends in the Democratic Party to once again return to their roots as the party of FDR, the party of working people, not the party of big corporations and CEOs and corporate special interests.
So, Nato, that circles right back nicely to the Bay Area in the sense of we're in the thick of an increasing income gap here in the Bay Area and lots of concerns about where this is all going. How do you see local San Francisco Bay Area unions working with pushing against these a lot of these, you know, trends that were supported by Democrats? After all, it's a state that is controlled by Democrats, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can speak about what our union, SEIU 1021, is doing. Our union has taken on a policy of sort of the idea of unionism for the common good, that our mandate is not just to fight for what's best for our own members, but to tie the union interest to the public interest. And so, for example, you know, we staffed and funded and did a lot of work over many years moving the local minimum wage initiatives in coalition with other groups that ultimately bubbled up to the statewide agreement on minimum wage. Now we're replicating that process to some extent with rent control. We pushed the rent control initiative in Richmond. We're working on rent control right now in Santa Rosa and in other cities around Northern California. We, you know, have been intensely involved in some of the housing fights around anti-gentrification and public land for the public good and supporting more affordable housing development. And so, you know, these are things that don't, in a kind of logical way, translate into new dues-paying members, but we feel like it's our mandate as an organization, and it's actually our survival. Like, we do a better job of representing our members and solving our members' concerns when advocating for our members is hand in hand with advocating for the community as a whole, and our members don't experience that separation. Like, when I meet with the members of our union and say, "What else are you involved in outside the union?" People, you go around the room, and everybody's involved in other types of, community organizations and civil organizations. And if they don't see the union as a vehicle for their political participation, they're going to find it somewhere else. And so we've really tried to sort of provide that to them. And you know, and we feel like it's been successful for us. So we're hoping to continue to expand that across that kind of effort across Northern California with other types of these kind of common good initiatives in our political work around the state.
You know, you hear conversation, you know, people threaten to move to Canada. Other people are saying, you know, it's you got to stay home and do the work here. And yet others are saying, if you're in a blue zone, move to a red zone. With that last piece, what are groups, labor groups in California doing to really help support their brethren, sistren across the country?
Well, you know, one of the things, like a lot, because unions have a national infrastructure, one of the things that is happening already is, you know, people are looking ahead to the electoral map in 2018 and setting up training members and using the resources and phone banks and staff and member volunteers of unions, like in the Bay Area, to support being able to win in competitive congressional races. You know, that there's been all this conversation about sort of this explosion of groups like Swing Left and Indivisible and Flippable and you know, Move On groups and stuff like that, targeting these other you know, either red districts or and so, you know, we're going to be supporting that. We're going to be I think deploying people to help out on campaigns in Nevada and Arizona and Colorado to help flip Congress in 2018.
Steve Smith?
And I would just add that in 2016, thousands of union members from California went across the border over into Nevada to work on the election over there, not only the presidential, but the Senate and the state legislature. Nevada workers have been under attack from a Republican-controlled legislature and governor, and we're losing ground and losing ground quickly. So we sent reinforcements over to Nevada, thousands of union members, flipped the legislature there to Democrat, elected the first Latina to ever serve in the United States Senate, and Hillary Clinton won that state. You know, this is something that we're looking to do more of, having partnerships with the western states of Arizona, Nevada, Washington, and Oregon, sharing resources. And I think that strengthens our movement. That strengthens our ability to get things done, not only for our members, but for all working people.
And Lemoyne, Werlein, Hyane, I wanted to bring the conversation to a close in the last 5 minutes or so by talking about the very near-term threats and concerns that you see. I imagine sanctuary city defunding, workplace raids, challenges in fair share paying, court cases in the Supreme Court might be going to the Supreme Court. Tell us a little bit about a smattering of concerns that you see that can really really change the power of organized labor in the coming months and years.
Well, John mentioned some of these in terms of right to work legislation, as folks may or may not be aware. So-called right-to-work laws allow workers in unionized workplaces to refuse to pay any dues or fees for the services and contractual benefits that are provided by that union. So under current law, a union is legally required to represent all workers in a particular jurisdiction without prejudice and irrespective of if they are dues-paying members of that union. So workers in a unionized environment, they can opt out of membership, but they can refuse to contribute towards the union's political activities, but they have to pay a fee for those representational and contractual services.
That's the fair share part.
Yes, and what's being contemplated now with the so-called right-to-work laws is essentially eliminating that requirement to pay for those services while at the same time maintaining that structure whereby unions have to represent without prejudice everybody within their jurisdiction. So it's clearly a measure designed to financially weaken unions and undermine their ability to function organizationally. So right to work is something that I would imagine will continue to work its way through various state legislatures, and especially those state legislatures where the GOP controls. And in addition, There are various right-to-work court cases making their way to the Supreme Court that would invalidate, you know, exclusive union representation and dues collection in that context nationally in the public sector. So certainly these right-to-work laws at the state level and through the courts at the national level represent, I think, a very big threat to the organizational integrity of the labor movement. And then there's also a variety of regulatory changes implemented by the Obama administration that attempted to create a more even playing field with respect to union elections and try to create some parameters and limits on employers' ability to file appeals and stall unionization in that way. And these regulatory changes had to do with strengthening election procedures. It's anticipated that those will be reversed by the new administration. So the labor movement really is facing the crosshairs of some very important long-term trends undermining unions' leverage at the same time that the new GOP-controlled Congress and the Trump administration are pushing forward certain policies and procedures that really directly undermine the organizational integrity of the labor movement.
And so, what's the answer here?
Well, the union movement, in many respects in the United States, finds itself with its back against the wall. And I think NATO and John's comments about the hard work on the ground of building a social movement unionism, of addressing members' concerns and issues not only in the community as well as work, linking up to broader movements out in society, I think that all of those strategies together is what is needed to put the movement back into the labor movement and make it a truly popular movement that represents not only the interest of its membership, but it represents the interest of the broader working class and of the communities in which they live.
And Steve Smith and Nato Green, I'm going to ask you each the same question in closing here. What's the opportunity or opportunities that you don't want to miss in the coming weeks, months, and years, because it could really mean life or death for the labor movement?
Well, I would say the old adage, the best defense is a good offense, very much applies to the union movement right now. We are engaged in an unprecedented level of internal organizing, meaning we're out there every day talking not just to some of our members, but all of our members about the threats, about the value of the union. So that if these attacks turn to reality, we are inoculating ourselves from these attacks by building power within our unions. That's a key strategy that unions are undergoing and a transformation that unions are undergoing right now in terms of how we build power for our workers through internal organizing, as well as continuing to organize externally and build power for workers that don't have a union.
And Nato, I'm going to switch a little bit that question and say, how could the immigrants' rights movement and workers' rights movement diverge in a way that could be bad for each? And what do you do to keep that from happening?
Well, if and when what LeMoyne was alluding to and, you know, right to work comes to pass, I mean, the Supreme Court cases that are in the pipeline now that relate to dues collection would overnight for many unions cut their budgets by 30-40%. And that's just an attempt to destroy the political power of the labor movement. And the only solution to that is for us to talk to our own members. And my biggest concern is that the unions will sort of become entirely inwardly focused and stop our successful engagement with our community allies.
Well, obviously, this conversation continues. But we have to pause here for this evening. And that's City Visions. I want to thank my guests, Nato Green, LeMoyne Werlein-Hayane, and Steve Smith for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to download podcasts and sign up for alerts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Judith Sansone. My co-host Ethan Elkind will be here next Monday as we discuss discuss proposed changes to California's sentencing laws. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. And if you want to hear more about this, stay tuned for the rebroadcasts of This Morning's Your Call.
Which is coming up next here on 91.7.